Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Hello and welcome to Nailers Natter in association with the Teacher Development Trust. And this week I'm incredibly excited to be joined by teacher, author and all-round education guru Doug Lamoff. And listeners will be aware of my long-standing admiration for Doug and his work. So I first became interested and involved in this work when I moved to Blackpool in 2013. And as SLT lead for induction, I was looking for a programme that new teachers could use to learn the art of teaching and the tools of the trade. And Teach Like a Champion was, and indeed still is, our go-to text for new teachers, with every trainee and NQT entering the school getting their own copy. The techniques and the videos that go with them have been a staple of our staff induction for years, and we also fully support our Teach First participants and their use of Teach Like a Champion. So in this podcast, we also discuss Doug and his co-authors Colleen Driggs and Erica Woolway's Reading Reconsidered, and this will be pertinent to many teachers listening who will have used the book in their own practice. I asked Doug about his thoughts on the Blackpool Literacy Project, organised and headed up by Stephen Tierney. Listeners will be aware of Stephen at Leading Learner on Twitter, which has implemented many of the recommendations suggested in Reading Reconsidered. So we explore the deployment of a literary canon, the importance of vocabulary instruction, and of course my favourite topic, implementation. So before we get into the natter with Doug, it's time for our weekly segment with the team from the Teacher Development Trust, and we have Bethan and David ready in the studio. Over to you, Bethan.
Thanks very much, Phil. Always a pleasure working with you. I'm Bethan Hindley from the Teacher Development Trust, and I'm joined by our CEO, David Weston.
Hello.
This week we're exploring the massive topic of curriculum and its implications for senior and middle leaders. We're considering the following questions. How can senior school staff design and implement curriculum change in their schools? How can they build the leadership of middle leaders in this area? And how can they bring all staff with them on the journey? To answer these questions, I've asked David to give us a preview of his upcoming presentation at our conference, Developing Curriculum and Teachers, Leading from the Middle, which takes place in London on the 16th of October. David, your session is titled Avoiding Resistance, Curriculum Change That Sticks. What are the key principles here?
Thanks, Bethan. Hello, Phil. The curriculum is suddenly the hot topic, isn't it? I get the sense that most school leaders are generally quite welcoming of moving the focus toward curriculum and away from internal monitoring and data, but it does throw up a bunch of questions about getting ready. There was a tweet doing the rounds last week, I wonder if you saw it, where a school middle leader was sharing all of the in-depth questions they were being asked on their Ofsted inspection. It was a massive list.
Yeah, I saw that list and it was causing some alarm, especially for middle leaders in small schools. So how can we use research and best practice around leading change to think about curriculum?
Okay, so here's a few ideas from my keynote next month. So there's a very interesting psychology of change, and it suggests there are five key things people need to believe in order to buy into change. These come from research by, I think you pronounce it, Armanakis and colleagues from 2000, and it's summarized really nicely on a great website, which is called scienceforwork.com. So the first thing is discrepancy. Do your staff really believe that improved curriculum thinking is actually desirable? Do they see what's missing in the current thinking? Only at that point do they really want to make the change. The second thing, do staff really believe that your plan to improve curriculum will help everybody achieve their goals? So it might well be they think, yes, curriculum could be better, but do they actually believe that your plan is going to make it better? Third thing, efficacy. Is there confidence within school staff that this is a place where people are good at making plans and carrying them out? Is there a history of implementing change well here? Also, do staff individually think they're capable of changing to a new way of thinking? Because any change needs people to believe that both we can change and I can change, and ultimately, are we going to make it with the new curriculum? Fourth principle is principal support. So that's leaders being really engaged in the process. So do your staff think that this is a real priority that you're going to stay really committed to over the long term? Or is it either a flash in the pan or just another thing in a huge shopping list of priorities? Fifth one, self-benefit. So for staff to really buy into curriculum change, they need to think that the new curriculum will help them to teach better so that their children will achieve better and learn better. It needs to feel like it's aligned with their values, because staff might think it's great for the organization but not good for them, and then they won't buy in. So we haven't got time now, but in my talk I'm going to go on and have a look at the steps that a leader would take in creating change that addresses all of these five areas. But I think anyone can benefit from just thinking of the five different psychological aspects. So we'll also get keynotes from international curriculum expert Tim Oates, from leading executive head teacher Ros McMullen on how she put curriculum at the heart of her school improvement, from leading lesson study expert Julie Jordan on the Japanese approach of Kyuzai Kenkyu, or that's in English, curriculum material study, and how they use it in a number of countries to develop teachers' thinking. And finally, we've got an amazing panel of school leaders chaired by the TES. They're going to talk about how to help middle leaders get ready for this change.
Thanks, David. Some really interesting psychology and leadership research there. Find out more about this event on the 16th of October in London at tdtrust.org/curriculum. Now, Phil, back to you in the studio.
Thank you, Bethan and David. And it's also worth pointing out that a previous guest of the podcast, that's Ofsted's Daniel Mears, is also going to be speaking at the conference. So it's going to be an absolutely unmissable day. Okay, so without further ado, now we're going to move into the podcast with teacher, author and all-round education guru Doug Lamov on Teach Like a Champion and Reading Reconsidered.
Welcome to Naylor's Nattering, musings on evidence-based teaching and professional learning. Follow us on Twitter at PNA1977.
Okay, so hello Doug and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
No problem at all. It's an absolute honour to speak to you. I've been a massive fan of your work for many years, and we use it extensively in the UK, and particularly the stuff that I'm doing over in Blackpool. We use your books a lot, so I'm going to be asking lots and lots of sort of fan-based questions of the kind of things that you've done.
I'll try and give you respectable answers.
I'm sure you will. The first one is just, I always start with a sort of gentle introductory question, so I'm sure that listeners will be aware of you and your work, but if you could just tell us a little bit more about your own personal journey in education.
Okay. As a teacher, it was my first job right out of university. I did it for 3 years. I loved it, and then I guess I got a little bit of wanderlust and wanted to see the world a little bit. I ended up in a PhD program in English because I thought that I wanted to be a university professor. And then I realized that wasn't for me, and I started a school in Boston. I didn't really know what a charter school was, but I had a colleague who was starting one, and she talked me into starting it. It was fascinating, and about a year and a half into it, she left, and suddenly on her way out the door, she said, "And guess what? You're the principal," which is, head of school. And I was 27 or 28 and fairly clueless, so there's a steep learning curve there. But as a principal for a couple of years, and then I had a job overseeing charter schools in New York State in the U.S. and trying to help figure out how we were going to assess whether they were good or not. I went to business school, wrote a business plan to start a network of high-performing inner-city charter schools, and ended up starting on common schools. And in the course of doing that, wrote a book about how to solve some of the challenges of teaching in challenging situations, and that became Teach Like a Champion, and that sort of forced me to get full time into studying and learning from teachers, which is what I get to do now.
Brilliant. And in terms of talking about the concept of uncommon schools, could you tell us a little bit more about how you went about selecting the schools that were involved and the fieldwork that you undertook in the production of Teach Like a Champion?
Yeah, great. So on common schools, we found and run high-performing schools in underserved communities throughout the U.S. So we're in the northeast part of the U.S. We work in New York City, in Brooklyn, some of the tougher neighborhoods there, in Newark, New Jersey, in Boston, in upstate New York, and in Camden, New Jersey. We have 53 schools. And the idea is to, a lot of the communities we work in, 3% of kids go on to university, less than 10% of kids graduate from high school. And so the idea is to put in these communities great schools that get kids prepared for university to go there, to succeed there, and change the equation of opportunity. So we've managed to start 53 of them. In the course of doing that, you know, we would hire great idealistic, enthusiastic teachers, and they would go into the classroom, and it would be really, really hard. And they would come back to us, and they would say, what do you do when, you know, fill in the blank, with all the challenges of teaching generally, and especially teaching in communities like that. And we found that we just did not have answers for them. And so I was recovering from my MBA at the time, and I ran some data sets where I tried to identify where the teachers were who taught in high-poverty communities and high-poverty contexts and still got tremendous results and still maximized student achievement. And so I found as many of those schools, of those classrooms as I could, and went to visit them to try and take notes on what the teachers there did. And as soon as I went, it was remarkable, it was incredible, it was inspiring. If you remember the best teacher that you had, it was like walking into that teacher's classroom day after day after day. And so I started to bring a video camera with me, because I thought people just weren't going to believe how good it was and how different it was and how amazing it was. So I started to shoot little video clips. You know, the very first teacher that I shot a video of, it looks like bad wedding footage. But you know, I started to study these teachers and take notes on what they did, and that, studying the case, what positive outliers did that made them different from other teachers, ultimately became Teach Like a Champion. And then my team and I tried to apply some of that thinking to Reading Reconsidered as well.
Yes, absolutely. And we'll come to Reading Reconsidered in the second half of the podcast. But in terms of Teach Like a Champion, you talk about the art of teaching and its tools. So what exactly do you mean by that? And I'm not sure whether you're aware in terms of the evidence-based movement that seems to be taking hold in the UK, but how is that different or maybe even complementary to the evidence-based teaching movement?
I think that's a great question, and I think they're complementary. I don't think art and evidence-based are in any way one excludes the other. I'll start with the word tools. Tools is a really important word to me. Its opposite in a teaching perspective might be program or system. I just believe that each teacher is different, that there's a toolbox of techniques that teachers can use to make their classroom more engaging, more rigorous, more dynamic, but that there's no one overall right way to do it. That what I want to do is give teachers tools that they can use to adjust and improve what they already do and be more intentional at what they already do, as opposed to tear up everything you do, start over and follow my system. If nothing else, I just think that that approach just feels lacking in humility for someone to write a book saying I have all the answers about everything in the classroom. You know, I think that most teachers most of what they do is really good, and it's a question of finding a few areas that they're interested in, that they want to get better on, without throwing out everything as they do. I always found that intimidating as a teacher. So the word tools implies pick one, pick the other, apply it to a situation, use it with your discretion as a teacher. That's also really important to me, is the autonomy and problem solving that teachers use. I do think that idea is complementing the evidence-based teaching movement. Evidence is really, really important. And I think there's a lot of alignment between what the evidence shows and what, I've found great teachers doing. But I also think that evidence is necessary but not sufficient. You know, I can know that retrieval practice is really important, or I can know that I have to manage loads on working memory from cognitive load theory. But just knowing that doesn't necessarily help those ideas survive their interaction with 29 skeptical year eights at 10:30 in the morning on Tuesday, right? I have to figure out how to apply that idea in a complex setting in combination with other tools. What other useful ideas do I use them with? How do I combine them? How do I adapt them? And so I guess what you could describe the art of teaching and its tools as being is building the environment in which evidence-based teaching, in which research-based teaching works, and finding ways to apply those ideas as effectively as possible in the classroom.
Definitely, definitely. And a phrase that we use quite a lot in terms of the research schools that I'm working with is the evidence should supplement, not supplant, the teacher's experience. Mm. And I find that certain...
I'm writing that down.
Well, I can't claim credit for that, Doug. That's not my phrase. I'm sure that someone at the research school will claim that one. But it's absolutely what we try to do in terms of giving teachers ways of actually using these things in their classrooms. And Teach Like a Champion is perfect for that.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. I'm glad to know it.
Well, coming to that, and Teach Like a Champion 2.0, I always make sure I say 2.0, has been phenomenally successful in the UK. And I also use the field guide, and I find it an excellent accompaniment working with new teachers and working with the staff more broadly. So how would you advise schools to best use the book?
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I think the first thing is don't try to do everything. 62 techniques, trying to do 62 things at once is the same as trying to do nothing, right? You have to be selective and choose a few things and try and do them well. But a couple of other key ideas, I think, in using the book. I love the phrase theme and variation. If you look at the videos in the book, I always try and provide whenever possible in the book and in the trainings that I do more than one example of any given technique. Because I think every teacher has to find what's consistent about the idea and what's unique to them or what they want to adapt to their classroom on any given day. And so schools shouldn't feel like they should be encouraging people to copy exactly what someone does in the video, but to look for the themes, look for the principles across multiple videos, and then adapt them to each individual's style and approach. And then I think it's important to think about both strengths and weaknesses. You know, all of us should always be trying to the work that we do as teachers is so important. And so, you know, we have a responsibility to always try and be improving and fixing things about our teaching that could be better. But when I look at great teachers who accomplish amazing things in their classrooms, they're not people without flaws. They also have flaws in their teaching. And interestingly, they'd be the first to tell you that. What they often have are just incredible strengths that overwhelm the opposition, the difficulties in the classroom. And so investing in what you're good at is as important as fixing or shoring up what you don't think you're good at. And in fact, sometimes people will say, when I talk about a technique in the book, oh, I already do that. And that to me is not a reason not to study something, but it's twice the reason to study it. Because if you're already good at it, you know, a few tweaks can help you be really excellent at it, or apply it in new situations that you hadn't thought about. And you're most likely to get benefit from studying it because it's already something that works well within everything you do in the classroom. So thinking about strengths as well as weaknesses, I think, is really important. And I would also throw out just the value of shared vocabulary. If there's one thing that I think is important about the book, is that it gives teachers a way to talk about all the thousands of decisions that they make in the course of a teaching day. And if you don't have technical terms to talk about the things that you do and the things that students do, it's really hard to have intentional conversations about getting better. And so, you know, teachers may hope they agree with some of my conclusions about the classroom. They might not agree with all of them, but at the very least, it allows them to take a vocabulary and talk about what they, you know, whether that was an opportunity for cold call, or whether I could have used whether I could have used everybody writes there to increase the ratio, and whether I checked for understanding. You may solve those problems differently for me, but it allows people to communicate more efficiently about really complex work. And I think that's really important also. And the last thing I would say is use the writing chapter, ratio for writing chapter, because that's my favorite.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just thinking there while you were talking in terms of how these terms have become part of the lexicon of teaching, certainly of the people that I've worked with. You know, you think about cold call, right is right, no opt out, everybody writes, as you mentioned there, do now, exit tickets, all of these things have become part and parcel, and people would understand those as well. Definitely.
Yeah, it's amazing too, because people do great things with them. I just started yesterday working with... trying to write Teach Like a Champion version 3, T3 3.0. I don't even know what it's called yet, but we started writing it. And at first, I didn't really want to write it because it's going to be exhausting. A friend of mine once said, you know, writing a book is the same as reading a book, except the book is trying to kill you. So I was trying to find every reason I could not to write this third version of the book. But as I started to talk about it with a couple of colleagues, I got so excited and motivated because the ideas that are in the book, teachers, we've seen teachers do such incredible things to do, you know, even better than what I originally envisioned when I wrote the book, that teachers take the ideas and adapt them and they do great things with them and they talk to their peers about them and they solve new problems with them. And I just find that, I find that process really fascinating and motivating. And I think that's what happens when you have shared vocabularies, people, you know, whatever's in the book, people can learn 10 times more than that just by being able to have conversations with their peers and being able to reflect on ideas in a precise and intentional way.
Absolutely. And you mentioned there about it's not just focus on, you know, the weaknesses, but also strengths. So I think that for my own teaching, this is just a personal reflection, but I've always thought I was fairly strong in terms of controlling the classroom, making sure that the behaviour of the classroom is how it should be. But a very simple technique that I always go back to, and in fact, I did this with staff training last week, and I might pronounce this wrong, Doug, but is it called Pastore's Perch? Is that what it's called? In terms of where to stand in the classroom. And it's such a simple idea. I just think that I always go back to that even when I'm leading staff training or I'm looking in a classroom. I always find myself standing in that particular position. And it's such a simple idea, but it works so well.
You know, it's so funny that you said that. I love that technique in part because it's named after a teacher who I just think is, he's the perfect guy to to have people halfway across the world using his name to describe a technique, because he's such a humble, gracious, hardworking person who, you know, just does everything he can for students. But it also reminds me, you know, the Heath brothers, Chip and Dan Heath, have this great book called Switch, which is about making organizational change. And they have this incredible observation that we always think that the size of the solution has to match the size of the problem. And that's actually not true. And if you look at, you know, studies on social change, actually very small solutions, very small changes can have massive and cascading effects in complex environments. And I think something really tiny, like standing at Pastor's perch when you give directions, suddenly you can see the classroom better and it's clear whether kids follow through. And so you can show your appreciation when they do and you notice more when they don't. And so they feel more accountable and they're less likely to engage in off-task behaviors. And suddenly your classroom is more productive. And, you know, little tiny things like that can have surprisingly large effects on a classroom. And I just think that that's, you know, when you're struggling in the classroom, look, we've all been there. I guess I'm thinking of, you know, teachers out there who might be listening and they've had a bad day or a bad week or a bad start to the year. Like, every person has been there, and there's a temptation to give up hope and think, I'm never going to be able to turn this class around or my career around or, you know, whatever it is. But actually, time, you know, when you start to see the effects of small changes, you start to realize how engineerable the environment is, and that, you know, it's a soluble problem.
No, definitely. So do you mind if we just move slightly on, Doug, into looking at Reading Reconsidered? And reading has been a massive focus for all the schools that we're working with in Blackpool in the UK. And we've used your work extensively along with the expertise of Alex Quigley, who's written Closing the Vocabulary Gap. Maybe you're aware of that as well.
And that's a great book, yeah.
It is a great book, and he does a lot of great work with us up in Blackpool. But our literacy leader, Becky Jones, has introduced a literary canon across the school, and we've actually changed the timetable to be able to fit in a fixed reading period daily with people working through this canon. So, I mean, obviously, in reading your book, why do you think that the canon or the use of a canon has declined, and how important is book choice in that?
I think book choice is one of the most underrated things in the teaching of English. It's so important. I think that the idea of a canon has a couple of things going against it and a couple of really big things going for it. The things that it has going for it is, one, it implies that, like, quality matters. Whether or not we all agree on quality, the idea that some books are especially worth reading because they give us cultural capital and they let us participate in ongoing conversations, or because they're richer and more thoughtful and they're better. You know, I truly believe that Lord of the Flies is just a great work of fiction, and that students should read it, and that it causes us to reflect on aspects of our society that almost no other book gets at. And I think there's a sort of sad narrative, at least in the U.S., that books are relatively interchangeable, and then what you're doing when you're reading is you're teaching kids to ask and answer questions about text and any text, and it doesn't really matter what book it is. Honestly, like, I think it matters. I think it's a great book, and the gift to students to help them read it. And I think the other thing that a canon does is it gives you a shared corpus of text that you can refer to. You know, no text exists in a vacuum, and we should always be able to make comparisons among and between texts, how they tell stories differently, how they address ideas differently. And I just think one of the real challenges of teaching in this day and age is that there are very few books that you can refer to and assume that all of your students will have read it, or that most of your students will have read it. And that just limits you instructionally. You can't refer to three other examples of an intrusive narrator, or, you know, examples of intrusive narration in three other books that you know your students have read. You have to ask questions like, has anybody read, you know, fill in the blank. And so I think that idea of shared text is very, very powerful. And so I think schools can recreate this idea of, we're going to set out for greatness. We're going to redefine greatness around our own standards, our standards as our own community up to date. We're going to let go of the power dynamics of a canon, capital C, across a culture, which, you know, I understand why people have a problem with that. But if you let go of that and you have an internal canon that serves and represents, you know, our school community, and we agree that we're all going to read these books, then you have a way of talking about shared texts across texts and being able to reference stories that everyone has read in a way that that makes those books much more relevant and brings them to life and makes the study of any one book much richer. So I think there's a lot of power there, and I really like your and Becky's approach of reinventing and updating the idea of a canon to enable shared discourse, just making it a little bit more modern, a little bit more flexible, a little bit more responsive, so we get the educational benefits of it.
Absolutely. So having selected the canon, and obviously we spent quite a lot of time looking at that, and it's very much an ongoing process, and we're not saying that it's absolutely where we want it to be. What approaches to reading do you advocate in part two of Read and Reconsidered, the parts that you called the fundamentals?
Yeah, thanks. Well, one of the great things about shared text, once you have it, is that it gives you an opportunity to bring the book to life. And so one of the most mundane things to think about when you're reading is how students read and how much students read. My son just went away to university this year, and I was talking to him on the phone last week, and he was talking about his experience. And he's kind of a STEM kid, so he's doing science and things like that. And I asked him how much reading there was, and I could just hear him rolling his eyes on the phone. You know, he said, you know, 4 hours a night, sometimes more. That's a lot of reading that you have to do if you want to make it in university. And I think about how much reading our kids do in schools. In fact, someone once came to one of our workshops and she said, oh yeah, I did my PhD, I did my dissertation research on this, and I followed 40 kids through their lives in New York City public schools, and the average kid did 20 minutes of reading a day. How can you possibly prepare to do 4 to 5 hours of reading of complex text in university if you do 20 minutes of reading a day? Combine that with the fact that this research was done before the book entered into its death struggle against the phone, which is kids read less, they read books less, they read differently. You know, they go home and they're constantly tempted by the device that is in their pocket that is flashing, telling them, hey, guess what Phil's up to right now? Guess what's happening across town? And not only does that mean that they read less, but when they read in a state of constant half attention, distracted, waiting for their phone to beep again. They don't sit with a book and lose themselves for an hour straight. And so one of the most basic things about reading in the classroom, reading a shared text, is you can read it as a group, and you can read it for a sustained period of time, and you can bring it to life, and you can sell students on the task of reading. And so the first thing that we talk about when we do reading workshops is what we call reading cycle, which is we're going to read together in class, and it's going to be a combination of teacher reading aloud, which is beautiful because the teacher is the best reader in the room, can breathe life into the text and sell students on how funny or how tragic or how moving it is, combined with students reading aloud, which is students practicing mirroring the teacher and also reading with expression and selling each other on the book. You know, if a teacher reading a book expressively sells me on it, hearing my peers read it expressively and laughing at it and enjoying it together sells me on it 10 times as much. combined with what we call accountable independent reading, which is long stretches of, you know, or significant stretches of me reading by myself silently from the text, but with tasks like annotation to help me learn to mark it up and interact with it and focus on it, and also to allow the teacher to circulate and make sure that I'm understanding what I'm reading. And so, you know, one of the things that's happened in the U.S. at least is, you know, choice has gotten valorized. And if you walk into a lot of English classrooms, kids are off in different corners of the room reading their own book. They never talk to anyone about it. There's not much accountability. There's not much shared joy in, we've all read this book and appreciated it together. So we're, you know, Colleen and Erica, my co-authors in Reading Reconsidered, we're big believers in the idea of shared text and the idea of bringing the text to life as the center of the class. We're going to read it for a bit, and then we're going to talk about it, and we're going to write about it, and we're going to read some more, and we're going to talk about it, and we're going to write about it. And those three different ways of reading, teacher reading aloud, students reading aloud, and students reading silently, balancing those three to build a culture that sells students on the power of books is, I think it's always been important, but it's doubly important now when every interaction is really an effort to convince our students that books are still relevant. So I think that's at the core of writing, but we, you know, obviously then there's a lot of stuff in there about, you know, annotation systems and discussion systems and how important that is. And I can go deeper if you want to, but I think those things are also really important. But I just think that fundamental of bringing the book to life as the center of an English classroom is easily overlooked.
No, absolutely. I was just going to go and ask a slightly different question, and one that you may not be in a position to answer, but working with new teachers and looking at both Teach Like a Champion and Reading Reconsidered, some of the newer teachers were quite honest about their understanding of a literary canon and their understanding of some of the shared text that you talked about. And, you know, we've done a little bit of a role in terms of some staff development and some staff training, obviously for those that think they need it or would want it, in terms of their understanding of those texts and the different techniques and ways that they can encourage reading. Yeah. Because, you know, their generation have kind of come up with phones and probably less reading as well.
We're addicts trying to raise a generation of addicts.
Yeah,
it's really true. But I think you actually hit, I think there's real synergy between the two books. So if I wanted to work on, let's say, some techniques from the writing chapter and Teach Like a Champion, the best way to do it would be, and this is another benefit of having a canon, I get together with all the other year seven teachers and we choose a book that we're all teaching, because we're all teaching the same book because it's in the canon, and we practice designing writing prompts and then answering the questions ourselves, not as kids, but as adults, right? What's the best answer we can come up with? We can practice doing our questioning with other adults. And what that does is build our background knowledge and our shared understanding of the text and deepens and enriches it for ourselves as teachers. We've also, in the course of doing it, practiced using the techniques that will help the classroom be more engaging and rigorous for students. And so it has two beneficial outcomes, and then I'm much more prepared for class because I know the book better and I know my techniques better. So embedding technique practice, I think, in a specific shared book that we're all teaching is just a really efficient way to do CPD. And it's kind of what my big project for this year is. My team and I are writing an English curriculum for the middle grades. And part of the reason we did it was because we felt like unless people had a shared curriculum that was aligned to a lot of the techniques that we talked about in Reading Reconsidered and Teach Like a Champion, it was just too hard to do the shared work of getting better together, you know, improving teaching as a team sport. And so in part it was about better curriculum for students in the classroom, and in part it was about better tools for teachers and their professional development.
Brilliant, brilliant. Now, I'm aware that this next question is a really big question, and if any of us had the answer to this, we would, you know, we probably wouldn't be sat here this evening. We'd be on holiday somewhere around the world. But how can we go?
Does that mean if I get it right, you're going to send me on holiday somewhere?
Well, I mean, you know, to me, where you are already would be a dream to be able to go there. I'm not sure you could say the same about Blackpool, UK. Although, you know, if you would ever like to visit, we would be more than happy for you to come along, Doug.
I do appreciate that.
So the big question is, how can we go about building vocabulary during reading?
I'm glad that you think that's the $10,000 question, because it is such an important question and hugely underrated. You know, you referenced earlier evidence-based teaching, and I do think that one of the key things that's come out of that movement that is starting to get a foothold in the U.S. is the idea that background knowledge is hugely, hugely important to reading comprehension, that it influences reading comprehension more than, quote, skills as a reader. And the single most important form of background knowledge is vocabulary. That said, I think that when we teach vocabulary, for the most part, we teach it as if it were a skill. At least in this country, we spend a lot of time. So if a teacher came across a vocabulary word, they might ask students, does anyone know what the word, what the word mimic means? Who's heard that word before? And we would spend a lot of time guessing at it. And the best case scenario here is that the process ends with a B+ definition of the word mimic. Or the teacher might say, can anyone guess from context clues what the word mimic means here? In the belief that this is a transferable skill, that if I learn to infer word meanings from context clues, I'll be able to infer the meaning of any word. And that's a beautiful dream, but it's a dream. Context clues are you know, insufficient or misdirected. It's only in a very rare case that context clues are sufficient to derive word meaning. And in that case, it's the word is redundant in the sentence, and in most cases, it's not. And so I think teaching vocabulary well requires thinking about it as a knowledge-driven endeavor. And that means, to me, you start with the definition. And I would say to mimic means to imitate, but in a way that's slightly pejorative, like I'm making fun of someone or something. And then I would ask students to play with the word. Would it be risky to mimic a tyrant? Why might it be risky to mimic a tyrant? Good. What would happen if you mimicked one of your parents at the if your big brother mimicked one of your parents at the dinner table? What might happen? What might they do? And students would have to answer those questions using the word mimic. And so what happens is, we call this term active practice. But instead of spending my time guessing at word meaning, I start with the word meaning, and now I'm trying to apply the word and use the word in different settings and problem solve with the word and use it as it takes different forms and understand its nuances and shades of meaning. You could argue it's a form of retrieval practice, to go back to the idea of evidence-based teaching. But I think that shift to let's start with the knowledge and then practice applying the knowledge is key to making vocabulary instruction better. And that could mean, let's say I'm reading a book and I start the lesson with three words that I know are going to come up in this day's reading. And we spend 10 minutes at the beginning of the lesson learning these words, playing with them, four or five different iterations of each word, so that when I encounter them in the text, I know them really richly and well. But it also could mean that I come across a word in the book and we spend 15 seconds playing with it. Great. That word is pejorative. Everyone say that pejorative, right? So just being able to pronounce a word is really important to attending to it when you read it. If you can't pronounce it, you skip over it. And then if you don't encode it in your memory, you don't learn from it, you're less likely to recognize it the next time around. And then maybe I give you a definition and I ask you a question or two about it. Who's being pejorative in the book right now? Yes, that's exactly right. Kevin is being pejorative. Let's get back into the book. So I could do little tiny moments like that to increase student attentiveness and attention to the words so they get slightly more out of them. I probably wouldn't do it with every single word in the book because I want the book to sing, but reinforcing words with active practice like that, I think is a really powerful shift in the way that we approach vocabulary. And I'm sorry for such a brutally long-winded answer.
No, that's absolutely perfect. I was just, you know, going back to that particular example and thinking about inference just with my own children and reading and the idea that, you know, inference as a transferable skill without any background knowledge, it's quite dangerous in a way. And, you know, without the understanding of the words, there's not really any way that you can infer across text.
Yeah, that's right. The problem solving is not in deriving the definition, but applying the definition.
No, it's fascinating stuff. I'm just conscious of your time, Doug, so I'm going to move it on a little bit onto what is probably one of my favourite topics, and listeners to the podcast will know this. So I teach science, and therefore I'm a bit of a sort of a science geek in terms of things that I like. So one of the things that I particularly like is implementation and the science of implementation. And I was fascinated to read about how you suggest that to the readers how to go about implementation. So how important do you see implementation is in developing reading systems, and what do you describe are the key phases in this process?
Well, Phil, I'm not just saying this, but I think that implementation is everything.
Yeah.
Honestly, A-plus implementation of a B-plus idea is going to be better in the long run than B-plus implementation of an A-plus idea. And I think that that's just, really careful and really careful high-quality implementation is going to win in the end. So I think that, a lot of the science of retrieval practice and habit formation is really critical here. The first thing I want to do is I want to roll out a system. I want to explain to students what it is, why it matters to them, how we're going to do it. And then I want to practice it with a lot of deliberate practice so that we get used to it and we learn how to do it right. And then I want to engage in some periodic maintenance, right? I want to make sure that my system remains sharp and effective. So whether this is annotation of a text, so I start by explaining why we want to annotate text. I show you an example of how I annotate, and then I say, let's try it right away. And I give you some feedback. Maybe I show call some examples of annotated text that students have done, and we talk about why they're effective and how they could be better. And I reinforce, I'm really intentional about practicing it 5 times in the first week. Then I built a system. Now students know how to annotate. They do it as a habit. I don't have to spend a lot of time talking about it. They don't have to use up a lot of working memory using it. It's now a piece of tacit knowledge that's operating in the background. And as long as I just reinforce it and maintain it with occasional attention, it's going to be really powerful. Same with something like discussion systems in the classroom. Like one of the ideas we talk about in the book is habits of discussion. Socializing students to listen as carefully as they talk during discussions and reference each other's ideas, right? If I roll that out, explain to them how to do it, have them practice it deliberately and intentionally for a few days or a few weeks, they're going to start doing it without a heavy load on working memory. It will make all discussions in the classroom more powerful, more listening-based, and then they can focus their attention on the text. So I think the steps are roll out, deliberate practice, and then periodic maintenance.
Mm-hmm. I mean, even before, and this is not something particular that you're going to, but even before rollout, we did a lot of sort of logistical arrangements, which I know might sound trivial on a podcast where we're talking about this. Yeah. But we had to make sure that we got infrastructure in the school to house the amount of books that we were going to need for a 1,200 pupil school and a canon that goes with it. We had to make sure that we had the time for the pupils to be dedicated reading time. Because previously we tried things like drop everything and read, which, could be successful, but only successful if it was done. So we did quite a lot of logistical organization before we even got to rollout.
I think that's, I'm writing it, I just think, not trivial at all. It's hugely important. All the steps before you even start in the rollout phase, logistical, and even teachers getting together to practice. You don't want the first time you do your rollout speech to be in front of students live with your year sevens, right? You want to have practiced it with a colleague and gotten feedback on it and make sure that it's right and make sure that you're confident and happy delivering a rollout speech. And you've talked through your system with someone so they can help you troubleshoot it and say, oh yeah, but if the books are in the back corner of the room and you say take out your books and you don't have a system for getting the books, then it's going to be chaos. So I think you're right that the real intentionality around the planning phase is I'm really glad you pointed that out. I think it's absolutely important.
And I mean, well, because
I can tell you're serious about your implementation.
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, I'm the kind of person that when I picked up Teach Like a Champion, I mean, we did practice giving out the exercise books and seeing how quickly we could get them back in. I'm that teacher that does all of those things to save the extra minutes so that I can do something productive. I'm the one who will go for the strong start straight away and the entry task. So implementation, yeah. But I mean, just on that, about schools that maybe haven't been as effective with it, have been the ones, and you mentioned it then, that have got a canon, but it's sitting on a back corner, but it's in a particular room, it's inaccessible, people can't move it around, people lose the books, people take them home, people don't bring them back, and staff's faith in something that you've implemented is reduced, not because of the quality of the intervention, but because of the quality of the implementation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. People give up on ideas, on that idea. Oh, we tried that, it didn't work. And then they start to give up on ideas generally, right? You bring in a new idea, it could be a very powerful idea, and staff fold their arms and say, not again. And I think you're right that that's part of the obligation of a well-run organization is to make sure that the things that we try, we're successful at, and we do them well so that, you know, the risk is otherwise a wave of cynicism and external locus of control washes over the school, and that's very dangerous.
Definitely.
And, oh. by washing over the school, I mean the adults in the school, obviously, yeah. As opposed to the pupils, yeah.
Absolutely. Okay, Doug, just want to say thank you so much for your time. I'm going to say, I think it's this afternoon for you, but it's this evening for us. It's been an absolute honour to speak to you. And, you know, I'm going to keep working with the books that the Teach Like a Champion, the field guide, and Reading Reconsidered. Just to finish off, could you tell listeners a little bit more about maybe have you got some timelines in terms of Teach Like a Champion 3.0, if we can call it that, or have you got opportunities that you're speaking, whether it be in the US or whether it be over here in England?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So Teach Like a Champion 3.0, like I said, I started it yesterday, so okay. I'd look for it in your bookstores in a decade. No, I'm supposed to have a manuscript done by next summer, so that would mean it might be out 6 months after that. But if you're interested, I'm going to be in London on October 3rd and 4th, and then again in December, I think it's the 12th and 13th, doing two-day workshops. The October workshop is on building positive classroom culture, and the December workshop is on Reading Reconsidered and a lot of the things that we talked about today. And they're typical of the workshops that I run with my colleagues. We show lots of video of teachers in the classroom. We analyze what they do. We do some practice. It's lots of fun. And I know it's a long journey from Blackpool and other great other places.
Do you know what, Doug? To be honest,
people will join us.
Yeah, well, yeah. Sorry, I'm interrupting you there. To be honest, it's probably the easiest journey that we do. Thanks to the Great British Trains, we are regularly in London as part of the Research School and the Teach Development Trust stuff that we do. It's actually quicker to get to London than it is to get around the north of England. So we could well be there in October and December.
I really hope you will. And as a side note, you know, every time I'm in England, English people complain about the trains and they say they're so awful. And so I just want to say, from my perspective as an American, English trains are absolutely incredible. I just think it's a fantastic system, and I love to take it. You can get just about anywhere. So for us from far away, it's a remarkable thing. So,
well, there you go.
Don't kick British Rail. There is no British Rail anymore, but don't kick them around. Don't kick the rail network around too hard.
And there you go, listeners. So everybody can get to London without a problem. The public transport is great, so everyone can go and see Doug in October and December.
We'd love to see you. Yeah, we'd love to see any of your listeners there. And I appreciate having the time to chat with you. It's been really fun. And I hope to. I won't be able to take the train from London back to Blackpool this time, but I hope to be in Blackpool sometime soon. Because I hear great things about it. I know there are several schools that I follow there, including yours, and it sounds like there's great work going on. So.
Hope
to be there soon.
Thank you, Doug. Really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil.
Thanks. Amazing interview there with Doug, and again a massive thank you to him for his time and his generosity and his Blackpool football knowledge, which was second to none. Unfortunately, didn't make the cut, but absolutely fantastic. So, into the shameless plugs section, and Research Ed Blackpool probably doesn't really need a shameless plug, as it has now reached 595 tickets at the time of recording. So if you're thinking of coming for a day of research by the seaside, then act quickly, and those last few tickets can be available through the Blackpool Research School website or through Eventbrite. Lead Learn Lancs is on the 12th of October, and I'll be speaking about using CPD to change culture in schools. So that's the work of the Teacher Development Trust in the CPD Hub, and also the work of the research school. And I did mention last week that I might be shamelessly giving away 2 tickets to Research Ed Blackpool, and that of course will depend on whether there are any left by that stage. My article for the Royal Society of Chemistry's Education in Chemistry magazine has generated a fair bit of discussion, and thank you to everybody that has got in touch with me about that. It's entitled Young and in Charge, so it certainly doesn't refer to me, but it talks about career pathways, career progression for new teachers. I enclose a link to that on the show notes. So if there's anybody else who would like to discuss that, then feel free to do so via the usual places. I also now have a YouTube channel, or at least I believe that's what the young people call it, and I'll be adding more content to this as the weeks go on, but at the moment it features the interviews and the introductions to the podcasts and the full audio. So if you find that easier to access, then you can get that from my website, which is nailersnatter.co.uk. Next week, we have Dame Alison Peacock on the work of the Chartered College. So that's a fantastic interview. We look forward to listening to that one. And future guests also include Jill Berry and Lisa Fathers. So once again, thank you for listening to Nailers Natter in association with the Teacher Development Trust, and see you next time.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.